I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The television has evolved rapidly since its invention in both its technological and its cultural influence. Today, we'll find out how the boob tube transformed into a dynamic 24-hour medium and learn how TV has forever changed America and us. After that, we're joined by a woman who made her claim to fame on screens big and small. These days, Morgan Fairchild is also using Twitter to reach her audiences, and as she says, not just about red carpet stuff. The TV and film stars become a prominent voice on current events and international politics. We'll ask her where that passion comes from and where it's taken her. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Television is ubiquitous. Screens are everywhere, and in a very real way, they don't just shape us, they are us. And the story of television is our story, too. That, at least, is the case our guest makes in his book, Television, a Biography. David Thompson is a film critic and historian. He's written more than 20 books, and he's joining us this morning from KQED in San Francisco. David, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. I want to start where you start this book. You point out that TV's been around longer than most of us have. We've not known life without it for the most part. And so you ask the reader to contemplate, when did you start to think about television? Let me ask, when did you?
Far too late. I think one of the things about television is that it has always been a sort of domestic thing, a household service. And, you know, we don't think about those things. We take them for granted. And most of us, most of the people listening, have been born into homes where television existed. And we took it for granted. We thought it was there for us. We thought it was warm and cozy and protective. And I think it's only in the last 10 years or so that with all the smaller screens we have, which are really extensions of the domestic use of TV, that we've realized that these screens are not just a warm, cuddly service, they're a dynamic force that is leading us to places we're not quite sure about.
Let's trace it back. Let's go back to the beginning and have you boil it down for us. When TV is first introduced, when it starts to become a household fixture, as you said, what was it created to be? How was it presented? What was its purpose then?
Well, television had been a possibility technologically for quite a long time. It was held up by the war so that there wasn't money to invest in it and to pursue it. But it really takes off after the war, and it seems to everyone to be a new version of radio, but a new version of the movies too. Although the movies were very hostile to TV, very disdainful of it.
Because they felt threatened by it? Or?
Well, I think also they thought that the small screen was never going to take over from the big screen. They had a very sentimental, romantic attachment to the size of the movie screen. And they thought, no, the public will never fall for an image that is as bad as the image was at first and as small as it was. Now we know that those very small images have become really a lot more compelling than movie screen images. Kids these days, on the whole, do not really go to the movies. It's a very sad thing for the movie business, but they watch screens incessantly. And at dinner, if you still have dinner with a family, you will find that your kids are looking down in a very sort of respectful, obedient way. And you think, oh, they're really taking this seriously. They're looking at the screen in their lap, which is a size and an image that the movie generation could not believe would ever take over.
And they're not looking at the screen that is the dinner table in front of them, containing
I'm
their family
not.
Around it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you set out in this book, which has been out for a while now, to tell the story of television, but isn't it really many, many different stories? I mean, can we really compare, tell the same story for the National Geographic Channel as for CBS, as for CNN?
No, I mean, television is prodigious and profuse. And of course, it's all nations, and television differs across the world. I make a big point in this book of trying to compare American television with British television, because I grew up with that. I was British once. And there's a very big difference between public service broadcasting and commercial broadcasting. And, you know, everyone assumes in this country that we had to go commercial. Other countries haven't taken the same line, and I think it's still worth talking about that and considering it.
Well, go ahead and tell us, what is the difference between, British and American broadcasting? A lot of Americans love British television.
Well, indeed they do, and I think that there's a lot of reason to love the idea of television as a public service for which everyone pays a license fee, which is what still operates in Britain. It's fading away, but it's still there. And something like the BBC then sets up to be a divisor of programs. And I think it would be very hard to challenge the model of the BBC, because I think it's been one of the great creative forces in television, as it was in radio before that. And on the other hand, you have a culture, very American culture, where nearly everything now, including the internet, which we didn't think would be the case once, but nearly everything is constantly invaded, and broken up and fragmented by commercials, by advertising, so that the whole process of attention and concentration have been altered. Now, that's a profound thing, and we have a political process now that in many ways is dependent on our not concentrating and attending. And we are suffering from it at the moment, I think.
Well, let's as we move toward that, those sort of big conclusions of what the impact of television has been, let's take it apart and look at some of the messages, the little glimpses of its content along the way. You know, one of the things that you talk about in a bunch of different ways in your book is the way stories are told by television, and some of how that changed, and maybe how we have come to think differently about a story. I mean, obviously, we've had books and we've had movies and we had plays all before television. How did TV change the way stories were told?
Well, TV says to us, and I don't think people really caught on with this at first, but it says really, look, you don't have to follow this. You don't have to concentrate or attend. All you have to do with me, and I'm your TV, is turn me on. I'm like the electric light, and I'll be on and I'll be there, and you can go back and forth in and out of the room, and you don't have to feel that this is a story being told, that you follow in every detail, that you understand. I'm telling you, actually, you can't understand what's going on, but you will get the atmosphere of all these things going on. And to enhance that feeling of a large, infinite atmosphere, we're going to give you something called the remote, so that you can go from one channel to another. You can be your own editing machine. And the stories of every channel that you go from in the process of using the remote, they're all very well, but you're making your own pattern and shape by using the remote. The world is open for you to select and edit from, and you don't really need to bother too much about the meaning. So television invents a process in which stories are no longer as realistic or as serious as they once were. And, you know, daytime television, soap operas are very much part of that. And even the series that we now most value, like The Sopranos, like Breaking Bad, which are tremendous works, I think, still, you don't have to see the whole thing. You can just see part of it. Twin Peaks is playing at the moment.
Right.
Twin Peaks is deliberately a show that says to you, look, you won't follow this. You can't follow this. It's not made in a way to be followed. But the atmosphere of the show is beguiling and spooky and frightening and funny all at the same time. So take a little bit now and then and don't really think that you have to see the whole 18 hours.
Well, so talk about a show that had, an atmosphere from a very early stage. 1951. Well, here, let's play a little bit. Maybe some of our listeners remember this one.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
So, Dragnet, of course. How important was a show like Dragnet?
Hugely important in its day. You can hear, I think, from just that clip you played, that it really is radio with pictures. Now, Jack Webb, the actor who played the lead in it, became a very, very popular and famous figure in the country. But it was a show nearly that you could watch with your eyes closed. Mm-hmm. The visual in television in those early days was very tentative, and the screen quality was very poor, but it was a direct development of a radio show, and many of the early TV shows were like that.
I mean, is it fair to compare a show like Dragnet to the police drama? Never seems to have gone out of style, from Chips to CSI to Law and Order. Yeah. Are these really just the same show over and over in a new day?
Well, in a way they are, and they do something that I think we all know is not really quite right. It doesn't fit with the America in which we live, which is that they say, and even Law and Order says it, they say that the cops and the legal system will take care of us. Now, they're going to find cases of immense complexity and tragedy and difficulty, but still, these are shows that advertise, as the title says, law and order, and they say you'll be okay. Now, increasingly, more and more Americans are living in a world where they know they're not okay, they're not safe. Television was a huge engine of safety and security for years, and that is fading, and it's going to have a very big effect on how we respond to the screen. We're seeing a lot of stuff now that is very alarming, very authoritative, but very frightening, and not to be trusted.
And to that end, I want to sort of ask about news coverage, which and live event coverage, which I think is something that a lot of people think of as sort of what ways that TV has changed their lives, or the things that make them remember the place they were. They're things that they saw on television. How fundamentally has television changed those, how we understand those dangerous, those societal changing moments?
Well, I think television has this capacity to give you the live moment. This is the essence of the appeal of sporting events, and sport has been a huge part of TV. But, you know, if you want to go back to 1963, live on television, we had the chance to see Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. Mm-hmm. A messy, untidy, but extraordinarily disturbing event. And one, I think, that without doubt changed the way in which people thought about the death of Kennedy. When Kennedy was killed, there were a few people who were prepared to say, well, this was just a chance event. This was one madman doing something. A few others said, can we really trust that? Don't we believe that these things happen by some kind of plan or organization? Well, a couple of days passed, and then Ruby shoots Oswald. And almost with a great lurch, you could feel the culture saying, this was a conspiracy. This was a representation of something malign but deep-seated in our culture. Now, we still don't know whether that was true, because really nobody exactly knows what happened with the deaths of Kennedy or Oswald. we live with the uncertainty. And it's an uncertainty, I think, that has had a very big effect on us and our sense of our relationship with our government.
And is that, is television to blame for that uncertainty?
No, I'm not blaming television for it. I'm simply saying that when we live in a media society, we're wrong to think that we can just use the media as we like and that they will serve us. The media are changing our sense of reality in profound ways, and we need to be very, very smart to keep up with it.
You know, I think about an event like 9/11, and it's hard to imagine experiencing that event any other way than on the screen if you didn't live in New York or near the Pentagon, yeah. I suppose. I mean, I remember being in my car that morning, hearing those first murky reports on the radio, and the first thing I felt like I needed to do was get to a television so I could see what was happening.
Well, television is a lifeline. There's no question. If we believe that something devastating, extraordinary, tragic, or jubilant, whatever, is happening, we do exactly what you say. We want to get to a TV because we believe it will put us in touch with it. And there is something fabulous about that. I mean, that's why the Super Bowl is such a TV event. That's why election night is a great TV night. And the last election night certainly presented very big surprises. Television puts us in touch with extraordinary, sensational, surprising events in a way that binds us together. There is unquestionably a real force in television persuading people that they live in one world and we're all part of it and we're all watching it because it affects all of us.
And do you think that's accurate, or is that a myth we're telling ourselves?
I think it's a myth that television likes to promote, and I think it's a myth that the whole theory of the global village likes to encourage. We want to feel that we are all living the same life. No, in lots of ways we're living very different lives. But still, if you hear in the corridor when you leave your office that something amazing has happened in the world, a volcano has erupted, a city has been destroyed, most of these events are pretty dark, they're pretty bad. If you hear that there are bombs going off in Korea, you want to get to a TV. And I think we all have a certain kind of dread but fascination with the idea that if the end of the world comes, if that big show, that big ultimate show comes, we want to see it on TV, even if the TV starts to melt.
And let me ask you about, you've alluded now a couple of times to the election night and to the ways that television has affected our political culture. Let's talk about the current political culture and the current president, who emerges from the world of business, but also from the world of television, the reality
totally.
Television,
yeah.
Whose campaign, I think it's a fair analysis to say, was brought to the world by television in a way unlike even previous campaigns, which of course have been televised now for generations. What is the relationship between TV and the rise of Donald Trump?
Well, I think we live in a world now where the alleged processes of government, like Congress, like the courts even, are in danger of being overwhelmed by media coverage. Whatever you think about Donald Trump, I think he has a genius instinct for how television works. My opinion is that he did not think he was going to win. I think his ambition was to promote and launch a new kind of television program where he would every night criticize his opponent who had won and would do a kind of frantic commentary on what she was doing and about what was happening to the state. I think that was his secret ambition. When we don't always get our secret ambition, and he was betrayed in the sense that he won, which I think may have been a moment of horror for him, because I don't think he wanted to win. He wanted to be on television. But now he has seen that another way of being on television is to be the president. And in most respects, he has been a television president. He's not enacting legislation. He doesn't seem to really have the understanding of how you do that. But he's good at getting on screens. It could be the TV screen. It can be Twitter. And we may like him, we may not like him.
Yeah.
But I think we have to face the fact that he is changing our relationship with government through his use of technology. And even if he were to be impeached, even if he were to be removed, what he has done to alter the dynamic of media culture, that is not going to be stopped. Every president who comes after him, assuming some do, is going to be changed by what he has done to the office.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Twitter as one of his primary means of communication, and in a way he has eschewed certain elements of accessing people through the TV screen that had become commonplace. We're hearing that there will be fewer televised press briefings, for example.
Right.
Is the use of social media, appearing on that kind of screen, is that really the same as the television that used to sit in the corner of the living room?
No, it's certainly not the same as that, but I think it's an extension of it. I think it is a new way of using domestic screens, screens we think we possess and control, to affect the way we're thinking and to affect what it is we are being told and what we know. After all, let's face it, he was elected by a portion of this country who stand directly in line to suffer most from most of the things he wants to do, and they do not seem to be aware of it. That is a major demonstration of how we all are being separated from the facts and the responsibility that goes with the facts.
You know, we only have a couple minutes left here, and I wish we had more time, but I do want to ask, I hear a lot of concern from you when you talk about television, but at the same time, you wrote a 400-page book that has obviously a lot of love and adoration for the medium.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day, is TV good for us, or is it bad for us?
I don't think there's any way you can come to a definite conclusion about that. You might as well say, is the air good for us or bad for us? Well, we know it sustains life, but we know the air can go toxic. Is love, our family, good or bad for us? Well, they are wonderful. They are a basis for our emotional existence, and yet probably most of our personal upset and tragedy and loss are also related to love and family. We are talking about profoundly complex situations, and there is no easy answer to them. Indeed, we should insist on the lack of easy answers. That's part of the wisdom that I think goes with understanding the media, never to trust the easy answers.
Are we in a golden age of television?
If you choose to see it, yes, there are wonderful things. I mean, we have had a whole age of long-form series that I think are far better than the movies being made in America. I think they're like novels stretched out over years on TV, and they have provided enormous entertainment and the whole range of feelings that entertainment is capable of. So, yes, there is gold. But, you know, our history as an economy is that wherever there's gold, there's trouble, there's violence, there's betrayal, problems.
Well, on that note, we'll leave television hanging out there, and we'll see how it turns out. That's David Thompson. He's author of Television, a Biography, film critic, historian. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And he joined us from KQED in San Francisco. Speaking of television and its power, when we come back, we'll turn to one actor who has taken her position of fame and used that platform to speak out on some of the day's most controversial issues. Morgan Fairchild is here. Don't go away. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske here on Up to Date. Yesterday on the program, we met the new Kansas Poet Laureate, and Sidney Blumenthal told us about Abraham Lincoln's early political career. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date or on the NPR One app. Join us on Monday's program. We'll find out how science got women wrong for so long and how new research is creating a different portrait of women's brains, bodies, and role in evolution. Also, how Kansas City's Quixotic pushes the boundaries of performance art. Join us on Monday for that. Maybe you know her as the original Jenna Wade on Dallas or for her long-running role on Falcon Crest. If you're a little younger, maybe you got to know her in one of her many and sometimes Emmy-nominated guest starring roles on shows like Friends or Chuck or Murphy Brown. She was Emmy-nominated for that last one. If you're younger still, or maybe not so young, these days you're getting to know Morgan Fairchild for something else, her politics. Today, the actor and activist is turning heads with her insights, and she's here with us in the studio. Morgan Fairchild, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here. Well, hi.
It is great to have you here. I know you've been here before when Steve Kraske was here, and I filled in for him to interview senators and musicians and authors, and I have never known him to be so jealous to be missing a show as he is today.
Oh, well, say hi to him for me when he comes back.
We will pass it along. Hey, I want to talk about you and what you've been up to, but let's start with the big news yesterday. President Trump announced yesterday that he was pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Accord on climate change. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, frankly, I think it's appalling. But you have to also understand that Al Gore and I were the first two people in D.C. talking about global warming in the 80s. And so we used to be on the same dais together, and Gore would lean over to me and say, you and I are the only two people talking about this, mm-hmm. and you and I are the only two people listening. So this is something I've followed and been an activist on for decades at this point.
Which makes yesterday's development pretty devastating.
Just devastating,
sure.
Because for those of us who care about this issue and have tried to educate the public about it over a long period of time now and watch a lot of the projections that we were talking about in 86 and 87 coming true, some of them even faster than we thought, like some of the melting of Antarctica and things like this, because back then people didn't quite understand the multiplying effect that would happen as things would feed off of each other.
Yeah.
It's pretty devastating and very scary. First, as a science, first of all, just to save the planet, obviously, but also for someone who's a science nerd like I am, and that's how I got interested in some of these things, it is appalling to me to see the science just rejected by a big swath of society. But it's also just devastating as an American to see the United States just abdicate its leadership of the world. Its position in the world as a leader on all kinds of different issues, this being just the latest where we seem to be walking away from our traditional place. So I don't like any of that.
Yeah. I am sure that some of our listeners have followed you closely through the years. Maybe others haven't and may be surprised mm-hmm. to hear you talking about some of these things. A couple of years ago, the website The Daily Beast wrote about you. The headline on the article was Morgan Fairchild, Badass Foreign Policy Wonk. said, the sex symbol and Flamingo Road star knows more about Syria and science than you do. What do you make of that? Or do people seem to find it surprising that you are, as you put it, a science nerd?
Well, people who don't know me, I guess, do. I wanted to be a doctor or a paleontologist when I was a kid, so I've always tried to keep my hand in. So, I have these odd hobbies, and I'm kind of a loner, but I have these odd hobbies. I'm, very interested. I post even on my Twitter feed, things on paleontology, on archaeology, on anthropology, on a lot of different issues. But one of my hobbies has been I've been following terrorist groups since the 70s, so I have a lot of friends at this point in the intelligence committees,
mm-hmm.
and are the community there. And then also just my science. So one of my hobbies is emerging viruses and epidemiology, which is how I got to end up being the first person in Hollywood sort of active on the AIDS crisis, because I could actually go on Nightline and explain what a retrovirus is and how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So it catches people off guard. But it's also what's interesting to me is that there are times when you are trying to educate the public on things, whether it's AIDS, whether it's global warming, and trying to put a face on it that they can identify with, that they can take it seriously. Of course, people look at me and they think you're a little Barbie doll or something, so sometimes that's been hard to fight against over the years. It's like the article you were just mentioning, and then Town and Country did an article on my Twitter feed a few months ago too. It's sort of a mixture of foreign policy, which I've always been very interested in because I'm interested in other cultures and how the world works, and then the science.
Yeah. Did you ever consider running for public office yourself?
You know, people have tried to get me to do it over the years. I just don't know that I'd be really great at it. But I'm always looking for people that I think would be great at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the people that from your Twitter feed I perceive you do not think is so great at it is President Trump. You know, he's been in office almost 5 months now. What's your take on how well he's doing?
Well, I think he's doing even worse than I thought he might do. You have to understand, I mean, I first met Trump back in early 80s. I mean,
yeah,
I've known him a long time. I've been to his birthday parties.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to the charity events at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, I've been around the guy, and I just did not think that he was presidential material. And but when he got elected, you know, you always hope as an American citizen that people will grow into the job. I think nobody who's ever elected is actually ready for the great pressure of that job. And I think everybody walks in and goes, oh, my God, what did I get myself into? But you hope that they will grow into it. You hope that they will say, oh, my God, what did I get myself into? I better,
right.
You know.
There's a humility in that.
Yeah, that I better get going fast here. And we don't seem to be seeing that. Mm. He doesn't seem to take the intelligence briefing seriously. He treats the intelligence community with great disrespect and just a lot of obviously a lot of the policies I'm not crazy about, whether it's defunding Planned Parenthood or all the different things, and certainly pulling out of this the Paris Accord. I mean, I really am very unhappy with a lot of the things he's done.
I mean, he came into the office as a celebrity, which gave him a certain a set of tools that maybe could be useful in the office. I mean, as a celebrity, as someone who also is on television, I mean, do you feel like there are things that would have contributed in a positive way to his work as president?
Oh, definitely. I mean, he could have done something good here. He could have taken all of that, the angst of the country, and he could have started addressing things in a way that benefited the country. I mean, he could have gone in. For instance, you didn't have to pull out of the Paris Accord. I mean, it's all. I'm sorry, I'm so sick. I'm having trouble with words today.
No, you're fine.
We each country got to define what their record was going to be, what they were going to try to achieve.
Right.
If he wanted to change that, all he had to do was go in and do that.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have to pull out. And anybody who's watched this over the years, when he makes a speech and says, oh, we're going to pull out and we'll renegotiate it. No, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. I mean, the weight of the office still does not seem to have hit him.
Well, I want to invite our listeners, if you have followed Morgan Fairchild through the years, if you follow her now on Twitter, if you're curious about her political views, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR up to date. You know, a political issue that I think sort of brings government and the arts together is the federal budget. And that's not a new story. That for a generation, there's been arguments over how much federal funding there should be for the arts. This year, there is a plan, at least the first draft of the president's budget would cut the National Endowment for the Arts dramatically. What do you think of that? I mean, isn't there something to be said, given all the needs of the world, that maybe we shouldn't be putting so much money into the arts?
Well, if you wanted to redistribute it or have a discussion on cutting some funding, but not cutting everything. I mean, the arts, not to sound like an actor, because I am, but the arts are a great part of a national identity and a great part of who we are as a culture. So to just cut all funding for arts and, if I may say, for science— and for the NIH and for all the research projects and for all the things that put us on the cutting edge of the world, for business, for the future, for America moving into the tech economy, for all the cuts that they're making across the board, not just for the arts but for other things that need to be funded, I just find appalling. But for the arts, you know, the arts are who you are as a nation. And whether it's great writing, great performing, great dance, great music, these are who we are as Americans. Mm-hmm. And certainly coming from Hollywood, I mean, Hollywood has set the cinema standard for decades. Decades and decades, people think of movies and they think of Hollywood. To take the arts out of American culture is to just gut the whole thing, and a lot of what the world turns to us for, whether it's music, whether you like hip-hop or symphonies or ballet or whatever it is that you like, or great writing. These are the things that define an American culture and every culture.
As you look back on decades, as you said, of activism at this point, are there particular issues that you're particularly proud of to have been involved in, where you feel like right now it may feel like you're shouting at the wind, but are there places where it feels like you've made real progress?
Well, I don't feel like I'm shouting at the wind, because I think a lot of people are upset at what's going on. And it took somebody gutting everything to make people realize it could be gutted, you know, that you actually have to stand up for your rights. No, I first got active politically, because I was always rather apolitical, after Reagan got elected, and the groups in Texas, the Republican Party in Texas, started trying to take evolution out of the biology books. I wanted to be a doctor, a paleontologist. The first issue I was willing to stand up for was teaching evolution in the biology books. Hmm. I don't care what you teach in Sunday school. That's fine. You know, I'm all for religion, of whatever kind of religion you have. But in biology class, you should learn science. And so that was the first thing I stood up for. Then my uncle had won a landmark anti-censorship case in the Supreme Court back in the late 60s. So my whole childhood and adolescence, every family gathering was, how's the case going? What is the bad part of censorship? You know, so suddenly, because I was standing up on evolution, certain groups were also trying to ban books in libraries. And I remember in Tennessee, they were trying to ban Romeo and Juliet because it encourages teenage suicide. You know, The Wizard of Oz because it says you're in charge of your life, not God. I'm not even sure how they got that one. So suddenly, you know, I'm out there defending, standing up against censorship. And so suddenly Frank Zappa and I are the team going on like Crossfire, different shows, you know, defending, taking a stand against censorship. You know, real Mutt and Jeff team there.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. But Frank was really quite brilliant. You know, he's a brilliant guy.
Well, and that gets to this this dichotomy, as you said earlier. There may be people who don't think that that they should listen to celebrity voices on matters of substance. But in fact, being a celebrity gave you a platform so that you could begin those conversations and show what you on your own had already researched and come to understand.
Well, that's the thing. I have all these odd hobbies. I study all these odd things, and epidemiology being one of them. And suddenly, when the AIDS crisis started, when Rock Hudson got sick, suddenly people were very interested in a new virus that I'd been following for years already. So suddenly I find myself on Nightline, literally explaining what a retrovirus is and all these things, and sort of became the go-to person for Nightline. When they did their first town hall ever, it was me with a bunch of doctors and scientists and congresspeople, 5 hours talking about AIDS. And when you say, what's the best thing you feel like you've done with it? I think that was the best thing I've done. I knew I would lose work because of it. It was very controversial. I've had people in the years since tell me that they know I lost work because they were in the casting rooms and I was considered controversial because I was taking a stand on AIDS. I lobbied Congress. I was there for the unveiling of the first quilt. I helped get funding for research, worked hand in glove with C. Everett Koop, who was the Surgeon General at the time, and Tony Fauci at NIH, just to get funding to keep the research going and also to take the stigma off of it. Mm-hmm. And people forget now, but there was such a horrible stigma to it. And I remember one of my friends from one of the magazines was a West Coast editor, and he called up when Rock was still alive and said, would we want to do a Hollywood Fights AIDS cover or picture? Would you come in with some other celebrities and do a Hollywood Fights AIDS? And I said, sure. I'm trying to get the message out, educate people. So a couple of weeks later, he called me back and said, thank you so much. And I said, for what? And he says, everybody turned us down. A lot of names that I could list right now that you would think of as being associated with AIDS later. He said, but everybody turned us down until you said yes. And then everybody said yes. And I, in the 80s, I felt that was a big part of my job, is taking the punches so people could get behind me and I would be the one out in front that would take the hit. But it made it safe for other people to come out too.
Do you feel like your political views have cost you anything? You've taken positions that maybe are popular at times, but unpopular with others, certainly with segments of the population they are, your criticisms of the president now. Do you feel like you have paid a price for being politically active in a way that an actor who doesn't do that hasn't?
Well, you always run the risk of making yourself controversial. With the AIDS crisis, I know that I lost work because of that. But you asked what was the best thing I've ever done, and that was the best thing I've ever done with my life. I know I saved people's lives. I know I helped get money funded for research. I know that I made a difference on that issue, something that was important, much more important than any movie or TV show I ever did. I know that I made a difference. No, I took the hit for it, but that's okay. That's a choice I made. Some of the other things, you know, you're going to alienate. I'm pro-choice. I'm anti-censorship. I'm working on global warming. I'm pro-staying in the Paris Accord. So, you know, people may disagree with that. And I'm always, you know, what I find sad about our culture right now is that people have to be totally one side or the other. People seem to be moving to the fringes instead of to the middle, where you have to hate somebody else or you have to demonize somebody else. In all the time I've worked on all these issues, I've never demonized anybody else. Mm. And I don't believe in doing that. I believe in talking to people and trying to find common ground and work together on issues, because that's the only way things really get solved. I mean, neither party has all the answers, and especially on the fringe of either party have all the answers.
We mentioned Twitter as one of the places that you really convey a lot of your views these days. I've had several people mention to me that they follow you. And
tell them thanks.
Well, I will. It serves it serves for them as this roundup of political analysis and news. And indeed, you retweet a lot of things from a lot of different kinds of sources. How did you get into all that?
Well, you know, I got on Twitter, and I'd always thought it was just like this thing where people just tell you what they're having for breakfast. You know, this was several years ago.
And there is some of that.
Yeah, I'm not interested in what you're having for breakfast, and I don't want you to know what I'm having for breakfast. So, you know, I'm not a food person, but I am a foreign policy person. So I got on there, and I started thinking, you know, well, what am I going to tweet about? I'm not really a big red carpet. I'm not a Hollywood type. People always think I am because of the image and everything, but I'm not a Hollywood type. I don't go to a lot of red carpet stuff if I can avoid it. And so I just thought, well, I'll tweet about what I'm interested in. And so I tweet about foreign policy. I tweet about politics, especially starting last year as Mr. Trump was emerging as a candidate. You know, I tweet. I don't try to sway people's opinion, but I do try to let people see the truth of what's going on, and then they can make up their own mind. And so, boy, since he got into office, there's never a slow news day. Mm-hmm. It's like, so, you know, you try to let people know what's going on in China, what's going on in the economy, what's going on in the world economy, what's going on in Mali, what's going on in Sudan, what's going on in all these countries. So at this point, I have a lot of people who tweet me and say, you know, I get all my news from you. You know, you have all these things, especially on foreign stuff, that I don't get on my evening news. I don't get in my local newspaper. And I tweet from a lot of different sources. I retweet a lot of things from different sources. I try to give a balanced view.
Yeah, I mean, where do you turn for balance? You've mentioned some progressive political standpoints you have. Where do you turn to sort of get the other side?
Well, a lot of people I retweet are conservative. Mm-hmm. And just because they may be conservative doesn't mean they're not appalled by President Trump. But a lot of the people I tweet are conservative, and I'm open to a conservative view. And like I said, I think problems get solved in the middle. I think problems get solved by trying to really assess the problem and what might work in a real world, not like off in La La Land for either side. So I have a lot of people say that. In fact, actually, last year I was having a lot of people, when the presidential thing was first getting started, tweeting to me saying, "It's so nice to have a conservative on here." And I'm, you know, I'm not. But because I would tweet things that would give a conservative side, not, you know, what I deem real right wing, but a conservative side, a sure. conservative point of view. And so I try to be fair. I try to give people an idea of what's going on in other countries, whether it's England with the elections they've got coming up, you know, what's going on. So people have a feeling of what's really going on in the world. I think America frequently gets a little too isolated.
You know, something you posted about last week that's been in the news is kind of the recurring issue of the freedom of the press in this country right now. And
anti-censorship.
Well, and you've taken that position for a long time. Last mm-hmm. week, we saw a congressional special election in Montana where the candidate who actually won actually punched a reporter the day before the election. How do you are you concerned about the role of press in society at this moment in American history?
Terribly concerned. Because, first of all, Mr. Trump kept encouraging people to be ugly to the press, even if not terribly violent, but ugly to the press during the whole campaign. I know some of those reporters that were feeling like they had to be escorted out of the auditoriums because of the threats they were getting. You see a candidate assaulting a reporter. This is not a third world nation. We don't treat the press that way. The press is the only thing that was actually enshrined in the Constitution in the First Amendment, the freedom of the press. It's a very important part to expose corruption and malfeasance of anybody from any party, and that's what it's there for. And we should be protecting their right to do so.
Well, you know, we only have a few seconds left, but we should talk about why you're in town. You're
in the middle. I'm in town. Come see the Dixie Swim Club over at New Theater, and we have a fabulous cast. The audiences are just loving it. It's very, very, very funny.
What's your part in that? What kind of person do you play in this show?
Oh, I'm playing the vain and frivolous, you know, sex symbol kind of thing. but don't hold that against the show. It's very fun. We have a lot of great actresses in it. We've got five ladies, and we're having a great time every night. And the audiences are loving it. I have a lot of people come up after the show saying they think this is the funniest one they've ever seen at New Theater, the funniest show they've ever seen. And so I think anybody who wants to come would have a great time.
Well, even if not every role you play suggests a keen political mind, that's the person a lot of people are getting to know, that more politically engaged intellectual side. Do you have any plans to act on that in the future any other way?
Well, there's a March for Truth tomorrow on the 3rd, yeah, and all over the country. So if anybody who's interested in going up for that, they just Google March for Truth, and I think you'll find one in your area.
It is the legendary Morgan Fairchild in town for a show at the New Theater Restaurant and sharing some of her political insights with us this morning. Morgan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Really a pleasure. You can download our podcasts or listen to previous programs at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and I'm at PTS Brian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Join us Monday, How Science Got Women Wrong, and we'll learn what goes into creating a dynamic, multi-sensory performance like the ones you've seen from KC's Quixotic. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you Monday. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.